from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Arnold Schwarzenegger is back again as the Terminator. Tom Cruise does it all again in Mission Impossible, and the dinosaurs rampage again in Jurassic World. But it's not all blockbuster deja vu at the movie theater this summer. Judd Apatow and Amy Schumer dish up the comedy in Trainwreck. David Foster Wallace takes a road trip in the end of the tour, and Pixar goes emotional with Inside Out. This hour on Point, A.O. Scott and Gray Drake join us to preview the movies of summer 2015. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you glad or mad about all the comebacks? And what's on your I'll See It list this summer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Studio City, California, is Gray Drake, senior editor at Rotten Tomatoes. Gray, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Oh, great to be here.
Also with us from New York City is A.O. Scott, chief film critic for the New York Times. A.O., Tony, Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
I guess we have to go to the Wayback Machine first, and all these, see it again for the first time, the Terminator, the Mad Max, the Mission Impossible, the Jurassic, what am I forgetting? I'm sure there's something. They keep coming and coming and coming. Gray, what does this mean? I guess it means that there's an endless appetite.
It does, and it means that we love the same things that we've always loved, and they are going to cash in on that. They being the Hollywood machine and the number – they're a bunch of pencil pushers in charge these days. But the only time that it's a problem is if the movie that they make now is bad. If it's good, then bring it on. I don't have any problem with seeing Mad Max Fury Road. It was unbelievable.
The age of the auteur, not exactly here, I guess, when they're all coming back, the pencil pushers. But what does it say about us as a culture, Tony, that just that we love our ingrained stories and can't get enough of them? I mean, after all, what, the Odyssey, the Iliad, they've lasted a while.
Yeah, I mean, you know, recycling and remaking and what we now call, I guess, rebooting have been around as long as the movies have, and as you suggest, even longer into antiquity. Certain, you know, stories and heroes and genres keep coming back. I think this crop, I mean, I think it has something to do with the age of those pencil pushers that Gray was talking about, that, you know, a lot of this, the stuff that's coming back, the Terminator, Jurassic Park, Mad Max, these were all touchstones of Gen X youth, of yeah. people who are now in their 40s and 50s, who are, I think, now running the studio and bringing back the stuff that they liked when they were growing up. Much as you saw, I would say, 15 or 20 years ago, there was a big boom in movies based on TV shows mm-hmm. from the 50s and 60s, when the boomer generation was running things. So I think there's a certain amount of nostalgia and a certain amount of, you know, oh, I loved this stuff when I was a kid, so my kids are going to love it too. And as Gray said, when the movies are good, that works.
So, Gray, if you're willing to consider the reboots on their own terms, their own souls, among those comebacks, see it again, what do you give a nod to?
Well, to be completely honest, I don't know that I can ever watch them with fresh eyes, because when I really do care, when I am watching a reboot of a movie that I first saw when I was about 13-ish, my heart is in it. And I can't separate myself from that child me, little mini me Gray, watching the movie
for the
first time.
It means this is never going to end, Gray. It means we'll watch these until we shuffle off the mortal coil.
I know. And when you think about it like that, it gets a little sad, which is why I try not to think about that, because this is the way that it's going to be, because our viewing habits support them keeping doing it. So I have to say, though, aside from, you know, my cynicism over all of these reboots, I really am excited for Jurassic World.
Because tell us why.
Well, this is a movie that I care very deeply about because I was watching it when right. I was that age right. for the first time.
Right.
And this time, we had a couple of sequels that I don't even want to acknowledge exist, okay?
Yeah.
And I think with this one, it feels as though they really captured the spirit of the first one. I'm very cautiously optimistic for this because with talent like Chris Pratt being that handsome rogue who's happened to train velociraptors into doing his bidding, I just think that it's going to be fun, and I want to have fun like I had back then.
We've got just a little bit of that. Fourth in the Jurassic movie series, Central American Dinosaur Park. Visitor rates are declining. So, new dinosaurs created, genetically modified. Here's the park operations manager, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, telling dinosaur raptor trainer Owen Chris Pratt about the new exhibit.
Every time we've unveiled a new attraction, attendance has spiked.
That was awesome!
Corporate felt genetic modification would up the wow factor.
They're dinosaurs, wow enough.
She was designed to be bigger than the T-Rex.
What happened to the sibling?
She ate it.
Boom, what happened to the sibling? Tony Scott Gray can't get enough of it because she was 13 and it was paradise and fresh and new. But, you know, when Michael Crichton wrote the book, the whole idea of bringing something back from just a little bit of genetic material was a dazzling idea. Now we know it very well. And still and still and still, there's the crowd for it, Tony.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that clip you just played is sort of a metaphor for the movie itself. It's like, you know, we need something new. We need something bigger to bring the audience back. I mean, that's how the Hollywood blockbuster mentality works.
But just a twist, you know, on the old genetics, right?
Yeah, exactly. We'll engineer this one to eat the one that we made before. And I think that there can be a bit of a diminishing return with that. I'm also looking forward to Jurassic World as a fan of the first movies and a fan of Chris Pratt and, you know, a dinosaur maniac back when I was six or seven.
Yeah.
So I'm always, you know, dinosaurs, as he says in that clip, dinosaurs are always gonna be the draw. But I think there is a danger of a kind of saturation on the part of the audience that we have these bigger and bigger special effects, these more and more elaborate spectacles that kind of tend to look the same and to reproduce very similar stories and very similar arcs and to end with similar kinds of big action set pieces. One of the reasons I think that Mad Max Fury Road excited a lot of people, in particular a lot of film critics who have just gone bananas for this movie, is that it's a kind of action filmmaking that is not dependent on digital CGI special effects, but is a sort of old school, you know, vehicles racing across the desert and smashing into each other. And it's done with great skill and imagination by George Miller, who's really an action movie master. And because it was something old, in a way, because it was really a throwback to an older kind of movie making, it felt like something very new and fresh and exciting to see.
And it's Mad Max, but it's got a big female figure right in the middle of it, Charlize Theron playing Furiosa. Max is Tom Hardy. Here's a little bit where they're trying to restore order in a post-apocalyptic world. Mad Max Fury Road.
It's all here! 3,000 gallons of gasoline, just like you asked.
My name is Max.
You said a few vehicles in pursuit. We killed three war parties.
Yeah, well, I got unlucky.
My world is reduced to a single instinct. Survive.
Gray Drake, we are reduced to a single instinct. What did you love so much about this Mad Max, Gray?
Mostly because the second half of the title. It might be a Mad Max movie, but we are on Furiosa's road. And I thought that Charlize Theron brought such a magnificent presence to this movie that was really different from the other things that she's done. Even when she was playing a completely over-the-top villain in the Snow White and the Huntsman movie, that felt really different from Furiosa. She wasn't a villain, of course, but she had that same kind of power. And the enthusiasm that everyone seemed to have for participating in a movie that, like Tony said, is real. That never happens anymore. And I think that that kind of energy just translated. It leapt into my heart and just made me start cheering. There was a guitar-playing gimp chained to the front of a Mack truck in that film. I couldn't be happier as a moviegoer this summer.
Oh, boy. And the old guys come back, too. Arnold Schwarzenegger's back in Terminator. First one was in 1984. You remember the line, "I'll be back." Here he is jumping out of a helicopter in the latest Terminator Genesis.
I'll be back.
What?
I'll be back. What? And the timpani drums go. Tony, you've got this piece with Manola Dargis talking about the summer's action heroes being several shades of gray and the fact that the audience doesn't mind, it seems, that the action guys get older and older.
Well, I think that that's kind of been happening for a while, and not only in the summer. I mean, you have the recent career, say, of Liam Neeson, you know, who's the action dad who is running all around the world, beating up much younger guys.
Save the children.
Yeah. And I think that there is something that we like about these older movie stars, that there is, you know, you could look at Clint Eastwood or Denzel Washington or Arnold Schwarzenegger, or, you know, you look at in the non-action movie star category at Meryl Streep, who is in box office terms a bigger star now in her 60s than she was in her 30s, and who has great commands great loyalty and interest from members of all different generations of the audience.
And she's back this summer as well.
Yes, playing a rock star.
A rock star, no less. We've got a lot to look at here. A.O. Scott, chief film critic for the New York Times, we're so glad you're here. And Gray Drake, senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. A little Mad Max, Fury Road sound behind us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with summer movies. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at summer movies 2015 this hour with Tony Scott, A.O. Scott, chief film critic for the New York Times, and Gray Drake, senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Tony's with us from New York. Gray from Studio City in California. You can join us as well. What are you looking forward to this summer? What's on your screen? What will you show up at the screen to see? We're going to dive into the lists of Tony Scott and Gray Drake, what they're anticipating this summer. Here's one that makes Gray. This is on your list. This is Paper Towns. Comes out late July. Set in a Florida suburbia. Follows high schooler Quentin, Nat Wolff, and his friends as they search for Margot, Cara Delevingne, who goes missing at the end of their senior year. Here's a little bit from the trailer for Paper Towns.
The way I figure it, everyone gets a miracle. My miracle was I wound up living across the street from Margot Roth Spiegelman. She was inarguably the most gorgeous creature that God had ever created. Margot's life was a series of unbelievably epic adventures.
Are you going to spend the rest of high school pining for this girl?
As senior year drew to a close, Margot and I were practically strangers. Until this one night.
What the? Margot?
I need to borrow your car.
What?
I have 9 things I need to do tonight.
Can't you just get your boyfriend to do it?
Ex-boyfriend.
Gray Drake, Paper Towns, it's on your list. What puts it there?
Well, the book was written by John Green, who also wrote The Fault in Our Stars, that was starring Shailene Woodley. And I loved that movie, and I really enjoy his books. And I think that part of it might be that I constantly am trying to recapture that mysticism of my youth. So I'm really working some things out emotionally here. But I think Paper Towns it features so many great young actors. Nat Wolff is really, I think, a star to watch. And I just really enjoy watching these young kids navigating their way through their movie lives. I think it's very touching, and it always ends up moving me, especially when I see the films with the audiences that they are intended for, the young'uns.
Paper Towns on Gray's list. Spy coming out very soon, just this weekend, with Melissa McCarthy, plays Susan Cooper, CIA analyst, anxious to give up her desk job to take on the criminal world. Here's a little bit from the trailer. She talks with her friend Nancy, played by Miranda Hart. This is on Tony Scott's list, Spy.
When I quit teaching and joined the CIA, I thought I was going to be this amazing spy, and I'm still just the same boring person I was.
You play it too safe.
I just hear my mom's voice. Just blend in, let somebody else win. Making a wave isn't always brave.
Brilliant.
Give up on your dreams, Susan. Just to write that in my lunchbox.
Spy. Tony Scott, tell us about what draws you to this one.
Well, Melissa McCarthy's not going to blend in and is certainly, you know, this I think confirms her status as the big, the most important comedy movie star currently. I mean, the movie opens today. I think it's going to be a huge hit following on The Heat and Bridesmaids. The director of this, Paul Feig, also directed those two movies. And it's got a really fun cast. It has Allison Janney. It has Jason Statham playing kind of a parody of who Jason Statham has played in all of his action movies. Mm-hmm. This kind of gruff, rogue, macho CIA guy who's a complete fool. And you have Melissa McCarthy just sort of tearing it up, doing all of her different comic styles. It's not a movie that makes a whole lot of sense, you know, in terms of plot or even in terms of character, but she can do anything. She can do the kind of like mousy, timid desk jockey that she starts out being, and then she becomes this kind of this super spy dressed all in black, chasing the bad guys on a BMW, swearing a blue streak.
Does she let loose with all that sort of rough stuff, gross out wonderment that she's so amazing at?
Yes, she does. So you see both sides. She brings everything, and she's just great to watch because she's such a lively, unpredictable performer. She's so funny in so many ways, and. I think it's great. I mean, this is another movie. I think one of the themes of this summer is this is another movie that is being driven by a woman that has a female character right in the center and is making no particular apologies for that and is not it doesn't feel like there's anything special about it in a way, which makes it so special and I think kind of revolutionary that here's a big budget, hard R action comedy, and there's Melissa McCarthy, and she's carrying it, and she's doing a great job.
Carrying Spy. Let's bring our listeners in. Oklahoma City. Doug is calling. Hi, Doug. You're on the air. What do you like? What don't you like?
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
I tell you what, I'm done with the summer because of Mad Max. Like, it was that good. I don't need anything else. it was so good. But I mean, we got to talk about how a big R-rated action film centered around a female hero is making like $300 million worldwide. That is so awesome. But I think another thing that's really attracting people to that movie are the practical effects. I saw that film and everything was so real. There's some computer stuff in it, but I saw Tomorrowland after that, and the whole movie looked like a cartoon, and I was so taken out of it after seeing all the magic they did in Mad Max.
Absolutely. How do they pull that off here, Gray? What's the not CGA approach, and how does it suddenly show up again so dazzlingly in Mad Max?
Well, the answer is about 30 years of planning. It's been that long since his last movie, and this has been an on-again, off-again plan for them since the last film, is my understanding. And so everybody wanted to be a part of it, and everyone spent an enormous amount of their lives figuring out how to achieve this. And they managed to do it over huge expanses of time. And I think they were more focused in on it for the last 10 years. And that is precisely why Hollywood does all of this stuff by computer. They don't normally have that kind of time.
But they put it together here, this theme again of a woman big in the film, Charlize Theron, very big in Mad Max. Of course, Melissa McCarthy in Spy, playing kind of the James Bondy role ultimately. We've got a bunch of others. Paper Town with strong female role. Inside Out, we'll look at that from Pixar. Ricky and the Flash, that's the Meryl Streep. Trainwreck has Amy Schumer in it, and I want to listen to just a little bit of that. Amy Schumer plays a magazine writer, party girl, thrives on one-night stands. She's writing a profile about a young sports doctor, Aaron Connors, played by Bill Hader. She finds herself actually falling for him. Here's a little bit in this scene. After spending the night with the doctor for the first time, she calls her sports doctor friend on the phone. His friend, the real LeBron James, is at his side.
Oh my God, he's calling.
Why would he call? You guys just had sex.
It's probably a mistake. It's a mistake.
He's butt dialing you.
Hello?
Oh, hey there, it's Aaron.
Oh, this is Amy. I think you butt dialed me.
No, I dialed you with my fingers.
What'd she say?
Shh.
He called me on purpose.
Hang up, he's obviously like sick or something.
Yeah, what's up?
I was calling to say I had a really good time last night. I was wondering if you wanted to hang out again.
Will you say that again, please?
I was wondering if I could see you again.
You know what? I'm gonna call the police.
Hold on. Yeah, I'll just talk to you about it tomorrow at the interview, okay?
Oh, yes. She's in it.
Bye.
All right, I'll talk to you then.
There we go. Train wreck with Amy Schumer. Great. This one also makes your list. What about it?
I'm just so excited to see anything with Amy Schumer in it because, lover or hater, I think that the work that she's been doing on her TV show and it looks like in this Judd Apatow movie is pushing the limits and making everybody talk, which is the reason that we go to movies, is to engage with each other. I love the way that it seems as though they're portraying her character. I think that she takes a lot of ownership of her actions, and it's super duper funny. This one is already screened at a festival. I believe it was just at South by Southwest. And on Rotten Tomatoes, every critic so far, 100% loves it.
Take us into that, the way she's portraying her character. What is it in the nuance of that, the portrayal that grabs you?
She's really taking ownership of her sexuality, of the way she lives her life. She's really enjoying herself. This is exactly the thing that all of these women seem to have in common this particular summer. They are who they are, not making any apologies for it. And again, the ordinary becomes extraordinary, just like Tony was saying earlier.
Maybe a summer of reboots, but pushing forward on that female characterization part right there. Justin in Winthrop, Massachusetts. Justin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am looking forward to the Brian Wilson biopic that I think comes out today, Love and Mercy.
Yeah. This is the legendary Beach Boys frontman who had a lot of problems with, bipolar, schizoaffective disorder, and this walks us through that. What draws you to it, Justin? The music or the sort of psychological story of how he came to that amazing music?
Yeah, I think Paul Dano, I've seen a couple trailers, and Paul Dano looks perfect as a young Brian Wilson. And I just don't think enough people know about the genius that went into Pet Sounds. And I think it's cool, too, how the movie shows kind of a more current Brian Wilson and the aftermath that he has to deal with.
Yeah, we had Brian Wilson on this show not so very long ago. He was terrific to talk with, but he went through some really tough times that this movie, Love and Mercy, captures. Of course, that one of his famous songs. Here's a little bit where he's hashing things out with an overbearing psychotherapist and a lot more, played by Paul Giamatti.
If you want to continue to see him, you should know
Brian is a very, very sick man.
Voices. I didn't tell you because I didn't want to scare you away.
The talking in your head, that's part of the song?
Jesus Christ.
It's part of the music.
You are not hungry. You think you're hungry.
Stop! Brian, time for your pills. Come on.
Love and Mercy. John Cusack playing Brian Wilson, Beach Boys frontman in this portion of the movie. Tony Scott, it's on your list. What puts it there?
Yeah, I reviewed it actually in today's paper. It is just a terrific movie. I think it really kind of pushes the musical biopic, which is a very tried and true genre, in some very interesting new directions, partly by, as the listener was saying, being very much about the music. It spends a lot of time in the studio with Brian Wilson, when he's played by Paul Dano, showing you how he made the sounds in Pet Sounds, showing you the genius at work, how what he heard in his head translated into these songs that we've been listening to now for 50 years. And then you have this other side of the story, which is 20 years later, where after a series of breakdowns, which are not shown, it doesn't go continuously through his whole life. It just shows these two moments in counterpoint. In the second moment, he's under the sway of this psychiatrist played by Paul Giamatti, and he meets a woman played by Elizabeth Banks, Melinda Ledbetter. She's a Cadillac saleswoman. He goes in to buy a car. They sort of start to flirt. They start to date.
Yeah.
And she discovers what's going on, that he's kind of in being held captive in a way by this guru, and she tries to set him free. So that's the second half of the story. And they play beautifully together, and the period details are wonderful. The performances, Elizabeth Banks as well as John Cusack and Paul Dano. And the music is really in the center. This is not – a lot of the times you see these movies and they're about a very troubled person who happened to be a great musician, and you don't really know what made the music great and what made him tick. This is really focused on what – how did this guy work to make these songs and these sounds that were so extraordinary then and that hold up so beautifully now.
I mean, that's a big accomplishment and another source of wonderment to be taken inside that. This, of course, a dramatic recreation of all that. You've got a documentary on your list of picks for the summer as well, Tony. Amy, the Amy Winehouse documentary. Why that one?
Well, I'm just intrigued by that one. I've not seen it. It was at Cannes, and a lot of people there were just blown away by it.
I'm so ready for that. How can it lose in a way?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's such a sad story, of talent, and a very talented woman, and a disastrous experience with drugs and alcohol and early death, her albums mean a lot to me. Back to Black in particular is just such an amazing vocal performance. So I'm very interested in seeing that. And, you know, there are a lot of music documentaries, and a lot of them are pretty interesting. And you always hope for one or two to come along that will just really, show what that form can do and how those stories can be told.
And this one does it. Amy Winehouse documentary, if the reports out of Cannes are anywhere near correct. Arthur in Springfield, Illinois. Thank you for calling, Arthur. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. The only movie that sounds interesting to me is the Terminator with Arnold Schwarzenegger. But I'm really disappointed with movies today. You know, it's like they didn't got no more imagination to come up with something new and something interesting that will, you know, bring more people. Not just the old stuff. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the old stuff, especially Arnold Schwarzenegger, because I grew up with him.
Yeah.
When he was started as Conan the Barbarian.
But come on, make it new, you say. And who doesn't sympathize to that? I mean, Gray, as good as some of these may be, and yes, old, ancient even stories get recycled. There's something about the form we hear in all the trailers, that big boom, 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 and you feel like, yeah, maybe great, but you've also been there before. Like, where's the auteur? Where's the new? Maybe it's not even in movies. Maybe it's off the movie screen now. Maybe it's in video games, or maybe it's in Vine.
Well, I'll tell you that there's a lot of it to be found in television these days. It's more enticing to sit in your living room in your jammies instead of dealing with a whole bunch of people in the outside world with a very overpriced cost facing you. But I'd say in movies, it's awfully risky to be new and fresh. And again, back to those darn pencil pushers that often ruin our experience because we already know what's coming. Mm-hmm. I think that we don't really support a lot of innovation as far as the big box office movies go. But as it has always been, in order to find things that I find really exciting, I always have to pay attention to the smaller venues. Anything that's considered an art house theater, anything now perhaps that's just streaming and available on Netflix or Hulu, one of those services, I think that's where you start to find the things that give creative people that outlet to be unique, because it didn't cost a lot of money as compared to a studio film to make them.
Tony Scott, I'm going to have to come back and ask you about that, whether it hurts as the chief film critic to have to look over your shoulder at all the TV stuff and wonder who's got the better thing going on. There was a time when film absolutely ruled. We'll look at that and more films with A.O. Scott, chief film critic for the New York Times, and Gray Drake, senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Gray's with us from Studio City, California. Tony Scott in New York. A little bit of Love and Mercy from the real Brian Wilson here, 1988 song. Of course, that's the movie as well this summer, Love and Mercy. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking summer movies. 2015 with A.O. Scott, chief film critic for the New York Times, and Gray Drake, senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. What are you looking forward to in the theater this summer? Here's a little bit of off of Tony Scott's list. This is from The Diary of a Teenage Girl, comes out in early August, takes place in 1976 San Francisco. No, it's not about the San Andreas Fault, but a little bit of an earthquake. 15-year-old Minnie, this is Belle Powley, and her sexual awakening, although sex for the first time, is with her mother's boyfriend.
My name is Minnie Getz. I'm recording this onto a cassette tape because my life has gotten really crazy of late. I had sex today.
I'm so happy.
If you're listening to this without my permission, please stop now.
Okay, Tony, it's on your list. What puts it there? Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Well, I think it's extremely sensitive and disturbing material, and some wildly inappropriate parenting or negligent parenting on the part of Kristen Wiig, who plays this girl's mother. But it's done. It's based on a graphic novel by the same title, and the movie is done with such honesty and sensitivity, and is so much on this girl's side, and kind of sees it from her point of view. And the performance by Belle Powley is just extraordinary. I thought it was. It's a very special movie. I mean, it's disturbing, mm-hmm. and it takes the situation very seriously, but it also is very funny and very honest, and you get a sense of this girl's personality, of her intelligence, of her curiosity, of the disastrously bad choices that she makes, and then how she deals with the consequences of those choices.
Is this maybe another face?
I think it's a very good movie.
Is this maybe another face, Tony, of what Gray was talking about, this unleashing or freeing of women's, or in this case, girls' stories? The liberation to, narrate your life for us.
And it's a woman director, a woman screenwriter. The original material is by a female writer. So I think there is this idea, and you see it on television too. You see it with Amy Schumer. You see it on a show like Broad City. That there's a kind of honesty about aspects of women's experience and a willingness to explore what had previously maybe been sort of taboo or shameful or had to be kind of dressed up in euphemism in a very straightforward and candid way. It's sometimes funny, it's sometimes awful, yeah. It's sometimes scary, but it's being put out there in a way that we've been used to for a long time, men's experiences mm-hmm. being played in movies than on television. And I think there's a lot of catching up to do, and there's a lot of energy and momentum from a lot of these writers and performers and directors toward doing it, toward kind of correcting that imbalance.
The Diary of a Teenage Girl, out in early August. Anne in New Orleans is calling. Hi, Anne. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
What are you up for?
I am actually looking forward to seeing Ant-Man this summer.
Ant-Man. And why? This is off the Marvel comic book story?
Yes. Because Marvel, in my opinion, has done something that obviously is very brilliant for them. They have taken a franchise and taken essentially a comic book, what would be a comic book series, and making this last for a decade between the movies and what's on Netflix with Daredevil and the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and they've run all the first stringers, and now we're just starting to get some second stringers, and I'm just looking forward to the whole thing.
We'll look at it. It's on Gray Drake's want-to-see list, Ant-Man. What the power here? This is directed by Peyton Reed. It's got to Paul Rudd, Michael Douglas, and Paul Rudd. Great is a con man who it's a strange superpower, but he can shrink in size but grow in strength like an ant. And I guess he can marshal ants to follow his will as well. What is it to put this on your list, Gray?
Well,
You know what? I'm just like Anne. I am a huge fan of Marvel and the confidence that they have in producing their properties. They know their material inside and out. And last summer, there was a similar kind of conversation going on around Guardians of the Galaxy where everybody went, what is this? Why are they doing this? This doesn't make any sense. And just trust in Marvel. In Marvel, I trust, I have to say. And I think Ant-Man is an interesting choice in the same vein. It's not one of their more popular series as far as wide mass audiences go. And I think that that gives them a little bit of freedom to make it very interesting. But earlier in the program, we were talking about fatigue that comes from similar storylines. And here's what I'm a little worried about.
Okay.
If in every Marvel movie, the fate of the world hangs in the balance, these movies are going to go downhill quickly, because one of the beautiful things about the Daredevil television show is that it's just about one neighborhood in New York.
Yeah,
very different.
Yeah, yeah. The whole world hanging every time, and pretty soon we may be a little exhausted. One can imagine that. What do you make of the comic book series from all over the place, Tony Scott? Do you share Gray's enthusiasm for the way Marvel does it?
Well, it's Marvel's universe, and we all just live in it. So, I mean, I think that, you know, as a business strategy and sometimes as a creative strategy, I think it's very impressive. I get a little I did like Guardians of the Galaxy, and I think that you know, Ant-Man is promising in the same way, just as Gray was saying, do a sort of a smaller, more offbeat, less familiar, less kind of central and canonical story. You know, I think that one of the problems is the whole sort of Avengers thing. I mean, that movie, Avengers: Age of Ultron, came out, a month ago, and everybody went to see it, and nobody seems to have anything to say about it. And I think that it creates these big pseudo events where people go and they have a pretty good time, or they're a little disappointed or whatever. But I think that one of the things that can get frittered away is a sense of excitement, of discovery, of, oh my gosh, you got to see this. And I think that the way that Marvel puts out its sort of its big blockbuster, you know, central movies is more and more kind of engineered mediocrity. It's like, we're going to make it good enough, but also bland enough and also predictable enough to cast the widest possible net and bring in the biggest number of people around the world. And that is not necessarily a formula for making the most interesting or memorable or exciting movie.
I want to ask about that around the world piece. First, here's another one of the big ones. This is the fifth installment coming this summer. Fifth, count them, five, of Mission Impossible. This one, Rogue Nation, opens the end of July. Here from the trailer, Tom Cruise plays Ethan Hunt on a mission to stop the syndicate. Talks to Benji, played by Simon Pegg. You also hear from Ilsa, played by Rebecca Ferguson.
Benji.
Ethan, where are you?
The syndicate is real. A rogue nation trained to do what we do.
An anti-IMF.
You want to bring down the syndicate?
It's impossible.
Desperate times. Desperate measures.
Desperate times, desperate measures. Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. It's on Gray Drake's list. We'll ask her. James in Nashville. You're on the air, James.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to talk about the fatigue thing they were talking about, because... Yeah, in my younger days, I was in L.A., and it seems like every film that comes out is a formula. And, you know, the hero journey kind of and all the obstacles, and sometimes the antagonist has to die three or four times, but he comes back to life. And I just wish that you and this show and these people you're on the show would do something to lobby for some sort of shift in format or formula, because it's hard going to the movies when you know what's going to happen. In the next 5 minutes, this is going to happen, and then this obstacle is going to show up, and then that's going to show up.
Okay, we'll see if we can take the challenge. Gray Drake, Tony Scott, my little piece. Gray, Tony, what are you going to do to shift the formula? I mean,
listen.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, everybody. This isn't just the two of us that are going to change the world. It's all of us together.
Come on, be the Avengers, be the superheroes.
I will I am excited about teaming up with Tony to fight crime. But in the meantime, we are voting with our dollars. So what you're talking about is just Fatigue in a big box office system. But I'm getting real animated in the studio here, okay, waving my hands around, yeah, because we need to find and seek out and support with our money the films that aren't formulaic. They do exist. They're harder to find. They could be streaming. But the minute that everyone begins paying for them is when things will change with large, wide releases.
Okay, so here's my question.
Yes.
These days, today, on this planet, who is we, Kemosabe? Let's say a lot of Americans do that, but everything I read says this is made for a Chinese audience, let's say, that likes action. There are 1. fill-in-the-blank billion Chinese. I don't know how many go to the movies these days. Do we drive the movies anymore, Tony, or are we watching Made for China?
Well, I think what we're watching when we're watching the big, you know, studio tentpole movies, the movies that the studios and their financing partners are willing to invest $200 million of production and another $100 million of marketing in. The only way you're going to get that money back is globally. So yes, they're making movies. Action movies of a certain kind, superhero movies, big franchise movies for a global audience, for an audience in China and Europe and South America and the Middle East and everywhere around the globe, and releasing them all, you know, in the same day in all of those territories. And, you know, that's not necessarily going to change by American audiences deciding to take a chance on more art films. But it's very important to support the middle and lower tiers of the industry, the movies that are much less expensive, but paradoxically much harder sometimes to get made and to get seen. It's actually in some ways easier. A studio is more willing to put, you know, $150 million into a reboot or a remake or a sequel than it is to put $10 or $5 million into an oddball comedy or an indie drama or any of these things. And I think Ray is absolutely right. It needs to be the audience. And I have to say, I do what I can, you know, with the platform that I have to kind of wave my hands and say, hey, over here, this little movie over here, you know, Love and Mercy or The End of the Tour or even a foreign language film with subtitles would be all right. You know,
imagine you'll
get it.
Let me look at one to do my little bit here. It's on your list. It's one of those, The End of the Tour. It's about Rolling Stone writer David Lipsky, played by Jesse Eisenberg, spends 5 days for a magazine profile with writer David Foster Wallace, played by Jason Segel. Wallace is on book tour for his big book, Infinite Jest. Here's a little bit where they're, from the trailer, they're discussing life.
I think that if there's a sort of sadness for people under 45, it has something to do with pleasure and achievement and entertainment, like a sort of emptiness at the heart of what they thought was going on.
I got a real serious fear of being a certain way. I treasure my regular guyness.
You don't crack open a 1,000-page book because you heard the author is a regular guy. You do it because he's brilliant.
Because he's brilliant. The End of the Tour. Tell us about this film, Tony Scott. It's on your list. David Foster Wallace brought to life again. What about it?
Well, it's directed by James Ponsoldt, who did a movie called The Spectacular Now a couple years ago. It was very, I think, very good filmmaker, and it's a modest movie in a way. I mean, it's not trying to be the biopic about David Foster Wallace. It's not trying to tell the whole story. It's taking a very small slice of where these two guys meet, and both of them writers in a way, and one of them writing about the other, and there's a certain tension and competitiveness there. And it just kind of hangs out and, you know, lets the guy talk. And Jason Segel, as David Foster Wallace, I think is... This will really change. It changed the way I thought about him as an actor. I mean, I've always loved Jason Segel, you know, going back to Freaks and Geeks and in the Muppet movies and Saving Sarah Marshall, but as a certain kind of, you know, goofy comic performer. And he really gets into... I never knew David Foster Wallace, so I can't vouch for the accuracy of it, but he shows you as much as he can of this very complicated, very talented... very thoughtful and very sad guy. And I just thought as a portrait of a writer and as just a movie about writing, which is a very hard thing to make movies about. It's very hard to show in a movie what writing is and what it means and how it works. I thought it was beautifully done. And again, I mean, this is a subject I am of the generation that read a lot of David Foster Wallace, and he was an author who meant a lot to me. And his death in 2008 was a blow and hurt in a way.
So there's a way to go back and explore that.
Yeah, and just to see without, you know, it's not tying up any loose ends. It's not trying to explain him or say, you know, why did he commit suicide? What made him tick? It's just trying to say, well, what was this guy like? What was it like to be in this guy's company in these very odd and awkward circumstances for a little bit of time? And I think if you're interested in that and open to that, the movie really provides something very, very special and unusual.
Inside Out is on both of your lists. Pixar film. What they've got the anthropomorphized emotions of a young girl in San Francisco. Gray, what do you like about it? The sort of joy and sadness and so on, voiced by Amy Poehler and Mindy Kaling and Bill Hader. Just got a second. What makes it work, Gray?
That voice cast, and as always, Pixar, even their worst films are good. So I'm in.
Inside Out, Amy Poehler voicing Joy. I read her saying it didn't come naturally to her, but she did it for the film. Giving one up for the team. Gray Drake with Rotten Tomatoes. It's always great to talk with you. Thanks for looking with us at Summer 2015, Gray.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be back.
And Tony Scott, the same to you, sir. Have a great summer viewing, and we will be reading you.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
Tony Scott, chief film critic for the New York Times. A little more Brian Wilson. Who can resist? It's summertime, California girls. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy movie going. This is On Point.
Back to the cutest